From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, lackluster stocks are the undoing of Ford CEO Mark Fields.
And Ford being a public company with a very strong family tie, who very carefully monitor their stock price and the performance of their company, that wasn't going to last very long.
Bringing the fastest internet service to rural homes and businesses in Southwest Michigan.
It's absolutely imperative today. It's an essential service almost as much as electricity is.
And it took a small electricity co-op to make it happen. Plus, small businesses dipping a toe in the water of a brick and mortar store for just a few months at Cass Collective in Detroit.
So it's that in-between of a one-day market and a long-term brick-and-mortar operation.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll look at a rural area in Southwest Michigan taking advantage of New Deal-era laws to improve their internet access. But first, he's headed up the world's biggest office furniture company, and he hired Jim Harbaugh as head football coach at the University of Michigan. Now, Jim Hackett is the new CEO at Ford Motor Company, replacing Mark Fields. Here with us, Aaron Bragman, Detroit Bureau Chief at Cars.com. So, Mark Fields out after just under 3 years at the top at Ford. How surprising was this shakeup?
It was really quite surprising for a lot of us. I mean, we knew there were going to be some changes coming down the road. The stock price has fallen about 40% in the last couple of years. And Ford being a public company with a very strong family tie, who very carefully monitor their stock price and the performance of their company, that wasn't going to last very long. And we'd started to see some actions from Mark Fields to take some actions to really try and rectify things and to boost that stock price and get the word out a little bit more about what they're doing. But apparently it wasn't fast enough for the family and or the board potentially, but Bill Ford delivering the message this morning that they've got someone new.
Well, following Alan Mulally and being the one to try to marry old Ford with its conventional automaking with the new Ford of mobility and transportation, that's a heck of a challenge, wasn't it?
It was always going to be very difficult to try and follow Alan Mulally. I mean, he was such a character and such a larger-than-life presence, and that whole folksy, homespun attitude was really an interesting smokescreen for people who underestimated him and what he could do.
At their peril.
I mean, it happened at Boeing, it happened at Ford, and he really proved all of them wrong. And following that act was always going to be very difficult. And Fields came to the party equipped with a lot of the knowledge of what needed to be done at Ford and what had to happen going forward. But he didn't have the same kind of personable charm that Alan Mulally had. And so I think that might have counted a little bit against him. I think that's part of the story. The other part of the story is the way that they communicated a lot of what they were doing to Wall Street, to the public, to the press in general. Not a lot of confidence in what Ford was doing because a lot of people just didn't know all of the things that Ford was doing. They tried to get some of that word out there, but the other thing that we haven't seen that mentioned as much is that the head of communications at Ford, Ray Day, was also let go along with Mark Fields. So they've got someone new coming in who's also a Ford veteran, but the idea that the guy at top of communications has also been let go is going to, I think, drive some change in how a lot of stuff is communicated.
Well, when you think that Wall Street values Tesla and Elon Musk more highly than the Detroit 3, so this is really an overall challenge facing all three of the Detroit automakers.
It really is. We're about to see a real fundamental shift in the way automakers make money in general. I mean, it's always been through selling cars and manufacturing, and now we're seeing a wholesale transition towards what they call mobility services, autonomous vehicles, electrified powertrains. And Ford really has done quite a bit of acquisition in this department. They've done a lot of change internally, but that hadn't been communicated to Wall Street. All Wall Street saw was that, yes, earnings were very good, but the stock price kept dropping because they didn't have the confidence in what Ford was doing going forward.
Wall Street was yawning. So what does Jim Hackett bring to this challenge as the new CEO?
Well, there's some new blood, obviously, and some new ideas and the way to turn things around. But this isn't so much a turnaround that's required here. There's going to be, I think, some fundamental cultural changes. Hackett was very successful at Steelcase in turning what was an old guard style company that had been around for 100 years and was very set in doing various things various ways and changing up a lot of what they did in terms of how the culture worked, changing up the product, being not afraid to take risks. space. I think we may see some of that at Ford as well. They don't necessarily need the same kind of world-changing reformation that Alan Mulally brought.
So they didn't need a car guy, although Alan Mulally wasn't
a car guy either. Yeah. But Hackett is versed in manufacturing. He is versed in Midwest practices as well. So there's some of the culture of being familiar with the people you're dealing with. But he also has that global outlook as well. And I think what Hackett brings to the party is a lot of familiarization with Silicon Valley.
What is job one for Jim Hackett as Ford's new CEO?
I think it's to rally the troops more than anything and try and bring some of that connectivity that they had to the top that they had with Alan Mulally. It would always seem that Mulally was very much among the people, that he was not the kind of ivory tower person that a lot of previous automotive CEOs and some even current currently are. But we're seeing a lot of that change in recent years. And I think that kind of took a little bit of a step back with Mark Fields. He did not have that same kind of connection with a lot of the rank and file. He'd been at Ford for 28 years. I mean, he's a lifer at Ford. And so it was very much a case of worrying about going back to the old ways of doing things, going back to the fiefdoms, going back to that, you know, intercompany fighting. They don't want to do that. They want to continue that whole one Ford idea of what Mulally brought to the party, but maybe some kind of a new action in that regard, a new direction to try and get that kind of connected feeling and that excitement back. It's kind of hard to do, really, when you're talking about autonomous vehicles. Cars that drive themselves don't have the same kind of passion. They don't inspire the same kind of excitement that, you know, the latest 550-horsepower Mustang might.
Bottom line, might we see more shakeups? Do you think this is it, or might we see some more post-earthquake tremors?
Well, we've seen a couple of positions move as well. We've seen Jim Farley has taken a new position. Joe Heinrichs has taken a new role as well. I think now we're going to try and see some of the trickle-down from that. They're going to require new people in new positions as staff and as mid-level management also happens. We may see layoffs. We may see people with job cuts as well. That's one thing that Hackett has done in Steelcase. He did cut a lot of jobs, but he didn't just cut them off and let them flounder. He actually took a very active role in trying to make sure that these people who did lose their jobs were helped, were tried to get some additional jobs for them. So there's definitely going to be some more personnel changes coming, I think, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Aaron Bragman, Detroit Bureau Chief for Cars.com. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
From one auto job, we now turn to tens of thousands of auto jobs. Michigan isn't the only place where car manufacturers have left, seeking cheaper labor and materials elsewhere. By the end of this year, not a single new car will be made in Australia. Many car manufacturing jobs there are moving to Thailand, where labor costs are much cheaper. And at the same time, foreign-made cars have flooded the Australian market. Sound familiar? One thing that doesn't sound familiar at all is what one company is doing to help the thousands of Australian workers who will soon be out of a job. The BBC's Vivienne Nunes reports.
Toyota have been making cars in Australia since 1963. 2 million of them have rolled off the production line here where I am now, the Altona plant in West Melbourne. But these machines will grind to a halt in late 2017 when Toyota puts an end to Australia's dwindling car manufacturing industry.
Manager David Wookey has worked for Toyota for 24 years.
We're in what is known as the body shop. So after the components are pressed together in the press plant, they come over to here to actually be welded together. And then from here, they go into the paint shop.
And I can see a mixture of robots and humans putting these machines together.
Yep, so the more difficult and the harder work we'd like to get the robots to sort of do. And I guess from the point of view of where we can find process efficiencies and be able to use the people to be able to come up with ideas to help make the cars better, then we'd like to engage the human element, if you like, into the process.
Why has Toyota decided to pull out of manufacturing in Australia?
One of the final decisions in regards to having to close Toyota was when both Holden and Ford had made their announcements in terms of leaving Australia. It then became very difficult and unviable for a lot of our component suppliers to be able to continue on beyond that, which would mean that Toyota potentially would be sourcing a lot of its parts from overseas. Given fluctuating currency rates and so forth, that would make it very difficult to be able to control costs. And so, subsequently, the decision was made to close the operations.
In October, 2,500 Toyota employees from this Melbourne plant will be out of a job.
Actually, the announcement was heartbreaking, very shocking.
Tony Thattle has been working for the company for the past 19 years. He's hoping to find a job as a consultant in adult education.
I've completed one diploma and I got 97%.
Often when companies close their doors, the most employees can hope for is a healthy payout. At Toyota, employees are being retrained in a job of their choice.
They have a plan, and if there is a program they want to participate in, and if it can be justified, they can go ahead and do it.
Many of the staff are retraining in the health sector. 20 production line workers are learning how to be nurses. Others are reskilling in construction or transport and logistics. The training is being paid for by Toyota, with some added funding from the state and federal governments. Pam Riley is Toyota Australia's human resources manager.
The fact that people are targeting growth industries, we feel pretty confident that people have researched their target career well and are preparing themselves in the best way possible.
University of Melbourne Management Professor Danny Sampson says,
I really have to tell you, I think it's very close to world's best practice. I've done a lot of reading about what companies have done, and I've never seen any other organisation do anything of this magnitude, and I've checked. I've checked plants that closed down, from paper mills in Scandinavia to the other automotive companies in Australia, the automotive companies like GM, Ford and Chrysler in the US, who, to my understanding, have never done anything like this before. And yes, of course, it would be fantastic if everyone could afford and would have an interest in applying this respect for people principle and put their money where their mouth is. Unfortunately, though, it's not common practice. It's just best practice.
Despite Toyota's efforts, finding a job won't be easy. Unemployment in Australia sits at nearly 6%. But the underemployment rate, or people who would like to be working more hours, is at 8.5%. The worry is that as the auto industry winds down, those figures will rise. Things will be particularly tough for those factory workers who speak English as a second language, after Vietnamese, Cantonese or Tagalog. David Wookie.
Many people came here in Port Melbourne. They stepped off the boat. The next day they were lining up at Toyota Port Melbourne when we had the plant there looking for a job. That coming to an end is going to be quite emotional for a lot of people.
There is anxiety, there is worry, there is fear, and people who are going outside of Toyota, setting up a life for themselves, wish them all the best. I wish myself the best.
And that's Tony Thattle ending that report from the BBC's Vivian Nunes. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Caddy. Let's show some love for Michigan elk. They disappeared from our state around 1875, but these days there is a flourishing herd of wild elk you can find near Gaylord, and anyone can go see them. Drew Youngdyke wrote about Michigan's elk herd for Michigan Out of Doors magazine. Drew, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Why did Michigan elk vanish there in the 1870s?
Well, back in the 1870s, we had unregulated hunting. So it was before we actually had structured seasons, quotas. We didn't have conservation officers or game wardens or a DNR to enforce how many you could take. So we had a lot of habitat loss, habitat degradation. At the same time, you had market hunting. And for a lot of wildlife species, it really put them on the brink of at least local extirpation. So the last Michigan elk was taken around 1877 near Saginaw. And for a period of a few decades, we didn't have any elk in Michigan at that point.
And what did it take to bring them back?
Well, they actually tried it back in 1916. There was just a handful of elk that were released, and they were released in different parts of the state. It was a small herd from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. They didn't make it, actually. They didn't make it, but there was just a few of them. 2 years later, a herd of seven elk that had been kind of culled from different city parks from around the country where they might have a public elk herd were released 3 miles south of Wolverine. So that's up I-75 north of Gaylord. And from there, they spread out and became the current herd that we have.
And I understand that reestablished herd kind of took a hit in the 1960s.
Right. So it was up to about 300 or 400 by the 40s. It was up to close to 1,000 by the early 60s. So there were some complaints from local farmers about crop damage, that kind of thing. So the DNR held a hunt, a licensed hunt, in 1964 and 1965. I think it was close to 400 or 450 that were elk that were taken through that, and that was deliberate. It got their numbers down. That was a trial run, but after that, their numbers kept diminishing, and what they found was there was increased habitat loss and fragmentation. There was more motorized access to those areas of the forest than there had been before. That creates disruption, and there was a lot of poaching going on. So in 1975, they actually released an elk management plan, started deliberately managing them, cracking down on poaching. You had everything going on in the Pigeon River country with the oil and gas development. So you had a plan for the forests. The Natural Resources Trust Fund came out of that. And you had some controls on the types of motorized activities, habitat loss and fragmentation started to recede. You had increased law enforcement through DNR conservation officers. And actually, by the time we got to about 1984, we could have a regular quota hunt again. And the current hunting system that we have has been ongoing since 1984, but it's really tightly managed. And it's important to note that the elk herd in Michigan isn't managed to have that hunt. That hunt is just used to control the numbers of elk, so we keep them in the areas where they're not going to get out and damage crops and create those same type of situations we have decades ago.
So where do we stand right now as we talk in 2017 as far as the size of the herd, the wild herd, and where they live?
Sure. So the elk management plan, last approved in 2010, puts a target of we want to have about 500 to 900. And that makes sure that they stay in those public forest land areas and don't kind of get outside those and cause trouble. We actually have a little over 1,200 at last count. So the last couple aerial surveys that the DNR has done have estimated a little over 1,200. Actually, last year they increased the hunting quota from 100 to 200 licenses to try to get it back down under 900. And every couple of years they revisit that. So we're probably up around 1,200 or more, but it's a healthy herd, a lot of great habitat, and a lot of credit goes to the DNR biologists that kind of keep an eye on them.
You were mentioning your favorite animal. Everybody in your family knows how right. much you love the elk. Why?
You know, I've seen them a lot when I've been hunting and backpacking and hiking and fishing in that forest. I'd spent a lot of time in the Pigeon River Country Forest. I'm actually on the Pigeon River Country Advisory Council for the state. And they're such a magnificent animal when you see them in person in the wild. In Michigan, you know, that's really the area where they are. It's all public land, so anybody can go on there. Anybody can enjoy them, try to keep your distance, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's elk viewing areas where if you're not familiar with the forest, you can drive up and see them. But where I've seen them is when I've been hiking through the forest or I've been hunting, and I come around a tree, and there might be a bull elk that's a 6x6, 20 yards away. And when you're used to seeing deer who are maybe, you know, 100 to 150 pounds and you see an 800-pound bull elk standing there, it just takes your breath away. Your heart beats out of your chest. You know, this year when I was hunting, I saw one within about 50 yards and I just watched them for a long time. I forgot about hunting for the afternoon mm-hmm. and just watched them.
Some might wonder, well, if the elk was nearly wiped out in Michigan once and came close to it again in the 1960s, why can people hunt them?
Because of the way that we do wildlife management in Michigan and really across the country, we know approximately how many there are. We know how many there are that need to be in balance with the available habitat that they have. And we make sure that we have a very limited quota. So we know that we can take out 200 a year, and that's going to keep us within that range that keeps them balanced with their habitat. And actually, a couple years ago, hunters and anglers, we had our license fees increased, and our organization actually advocated for that increase because it meant that we put more conservation officers on the ground enforcing the penalties. Our organization pressured the legislature a couple years ago to increase the poaching fine for elk. So if you poach an elk, it's going to cost you over $10,000. We have more COs in the field enforcing that. We have very diligent DNR biologists estimating, you know, every couple years, okay, I think this year we can take 100, maybe this year we can take 200 and keep us within that range that we need. When you have that system going on that's all funded by the hunting licenses that we purchase as hunters, then you have a balanced system, you have a healthy herd, you have healthy wildlife habitat, you have landowners that still respect the animal because they're not trampling their crops, mm-hmm. and you have the opportunity for anybody, whether they hunt or not, to go out there and enjoy them. So that's kind of the system that we have right now. It's in good balance right now, and kind of what we try to do is try to keep it in good balance.
The piece that you wrote about elk for Michigan Outdoors Magazine, you called elk one of Michigan's best-kept secrets. How can people find out more? You mentioned, for example, public viewing areas. Where should they go to find out more?
So you can actually go up to the headquarters in the Pigeon River Country. You can find the address there on the DNR website. It's michigan.gov/DNR. On the headquarters, there's different maps of the area. There's a couple areas that are designated wildlife viewing areas. Actually, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and the Pigeon River Country Advisory Council teamed up to put up some kiosks at a couple of those areas where you might pull off and park to describe elk history. And that's kind of the entryway into seeing them if you're not somebody who tramps around the backwoods and sees them that way. So, you know, in the right time of year up in the Pigeon River country, you almost can't help but to see them. And if you stay,
what's the right time of year?
Well, one of the best times of the year is September. They come into the breeding season in September and October. When it gets to be October, though, you got to be a little bit careful because that's when you have all the bow hunters out, you have more hunters out. So they're going to move them a little bit more. What that's also going to do is the elk are going to be a little bit tougher to see because there's hunting pressure, not on them, but just hunting pressure in general in the forest. So, you know, early September, I think, is a really great time to see them.
One of our stateside team, Mike Blank, remembers a camping trip. And he said in the middle of the night, he said there was the most incredibly strange noise that scared him to death. And he later learned it was an elk. And that's this bugling you were talking about?
Absolutely. It's
what's the sound like?
Well, don't ask me to mimic it.
No, no.
You know, when I yawn, my wife says that I sound like a bugling elk when I yawn. But it's high-pitched and deep at the same time. It really reverberates throughout the woods. You feel it in your chest when you hear it, especially when they're close. You know, a similar story to that is a couple years ago, my uncle came out with us at deer camp. And my uncle has cerebral palsy. He doesn't hunt himself, but we set up a little pop-up blind close to where we set up our wall tent camp just so we could see wildlife. And we were really hoping that he'd be able to see an elk because he's over from Central Lake, a little bit further west outside of the elk range. And when he was walking back to camp, his story was, and I don't know exactly how close they came, but he said, they almost ran me over, you know, from a few cows and a couple little spike bulls. So to me, that experience is what elk in Michigan are all about. You have somebody from a different part of the state who might not even know that we have it. They come up to this beautiful public land state forest that we have. When they see elk, when they experience them, hopefully they appreciate the animal, but they appreciate what that public land provides for them too. And that becomes important when, you know, certain politicians might try to sell it. Hopefully that's an advocate now that we have that will write their legislator and say, no, we want to keep this public. And that's why I really appreciate elk as well.
Drew Youngdyke is the editor of Michigan Out of Doors. Thanks so much for sharing your passion for Michigan elk with us.
Thank you very much.
Collaborative, heart of the community. The next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
So you've got a small business. You've been selling your product at farmers markets or art fairs or maybe online. But it's a great big step from that to having your own brick and mortar store. One way to help bridge that gap is happening in Midtown Detroit, Cass Collective. It's a new collaborative retail space where businesses rotate in and out so a budding entrepreneur can put a cautious toe in the water without having to sign a long lease. Cass Collective is a joint project of Midtown Detroit, Inc. and Tech Town Detroit. With us now from Tech Town Detroit is Sarah Donnelly. Welcome, Sarah, to The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Would it be fair to describe Cass Collective as like a hybrid, a cross between a one-time pop-up event and a full-time brick-and-mortar store?
Absolutely. The Cass Collective is an opportunity for small businesses to have the experience of running a brick-and-mortar shop before they jump right into a long-term lease. So it's that in-between of a one-day market and a long-term brick-and-mortar operation.
Tell us about the space.
The space is an open-air space where six vendors have the opportunity to operate, you know, their own individual businesses while also feeding off of each other. So we have businesses that are, you know, making their own bow ties on site, but they sell, you know, menswear from head to toe, from the suit to shoes, but you have that on-site production. We have jewelry makers using raw materials like leather and fabrics that are also producing on-site while they show the rest of their assortment. We have clothing providers. We have vintage, you know, women's clothing in the space. We have someone who imports olive oil directly from Italy and makes handmade bath products. So the beautiful thing about the space is that while each business can preserve their own identity within their small footprint, they also have the opportunity to collaborate with each other. The customer that is visiting the space, they can really go on the journey and discover things as they turn the corner. In addition to the retail space, there's also an opportunity for external parties to rent a conference room that is adjoining to host off-site meetings, art shows, and also the tenants that are in the space, they also can rent that area to host their own trunk shows, you know, classes on how to make jewelry, how to tie a bow tie. There's just a variety of opportunities beyond leading with the retail experience and then showing what else you can do within that area.
I'm going to say, just even as a prospective customer, it sounds very lively and very cool. How are the vendors chosen for this?
TechTown Detroit and Midtown collaborated on programming the assortment of vendors. So we looked at, have these businesses been popping up around the city? Do they have a customer base? Do they have an online presence? Some of the businesses have been in a different type of collective environment. Some have had their own brick-and-mortar experience, and others are looking to see if brick-and-mortar is the right path for them.
Now, how is Cass Collective funded? I mean, do these folks pay rent?
They do pay rent. They absolutely pay rent. We don't think it would be setting up anybody for success if they didn't have skin in the game, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they have their own space, they are going to have to manage their finances and manage that accordingly. So this is setting them up for that type of management and experience. So they do pay rent. And then it is also subsidized by TechTown and Midtown.
And it also, knowing the kind of work you do at TechTown, these folks are getting guidance, aren't they, as they go through their ventures to help them take things to whatever the next level is for them?
Absolutely. So in addition to, you know, the front-running value add for these businesses is that they have the opportunity to operate in the lively retail environment that is in Midtown. So they certainly have that, you know, access to that audience and that footprint. And in addition to, while they are in the space, and they all are operating on 3-month leases, that we, you know, we have a conversation to see if they want to renew that lease. But they are in 3-month increments. While they are in the space, they have access to the services from TechTown, which includes workshops that are catered directly towards their businesses, because it's only a group of 6, right,
yeah,
rather than a group of 30. I'm also working with the businesses to do deep dive assessments of their operations, and then we are going to be working on a milestone plan while they are in the space. And the goal is to help them have that real-life experience to help them determine what their next step is, right? Potential success could be certainly, you know, they want to have their own brick-and-mortar space. They have the experience under their belt. Okay, well, let's help you find a location. Is the Midtown neighborhood where you want to ultimately land? Can we support you looking at other neighborhoods in the city? So brick-and-mortar can certainly be a path of a successful tenure. Also, businesses, because they've had the day-to-day in-and-out experience, they could also identify, you know what, being in this collective model, this is really where I thrive and what my customers are enjoying. Okay, well then how can we look at other models?
Could an idea like this, Sarah, work elsewhere in the state? I mean, what would be your advice to organizations who want to try this collaborative retail space to drive small business?
I certainly believe that the Cass Collective model could work in other areas of the state. There are, you know, a plethora of small business owners that are producing out of their home, making goods, doing home parties, doing the vendor, you know, market circuit. So I certainly think that could be an opportunity. There are also businesses that perhaps chose too much square footage for their initial brick and mortar, you know, operations. So this model can also help people identify, you know what, I don't need as much space, right? But I certainly think this could work in other locations. I mean, when we look at the state of retail as it is, right, I mean, you can't go a day without pulling up an article about brick and mortar retail is dying and this department store is closing down and
right,
jobs are being lost. This is a way to sustain jobs, create jobs, because we're really using that go slow to go fast mentality. This model can be a way for people to triage their idea and really understand the value of that in-person customer experience and also how to operate their business online as well. I don't think that there's a retail business that can operate only through one channel, right? And brick-and-mortar retail is not dying. It's simply going through a makeover, I guess you could say. There are national brands that are shifting because consumers want experiences rather than simply buying product. And a model like the Cass Collective can provide that experience, right? And it's always going to be changing, whether the tenants themselves change or whether they're making new product. It's a very engaging environment.
You can find out more about the Cass Collective by going to its Facebook page, and I'm sure that will have location and hours. But what if I'm a business owner and I want to go to your boot camp? How do I find out more?
Absolutely. Go to techtowndetroit.org/retailbootcamp. Applications close June 4th. We are also hosting an info session here at TechTown on Wednesday, May 31st.
Sarah Donnelly is with TechTown Detroit, the business accelerator and incubator, and a partner in the Cass Collective in Midtown Detroit. Very exciting, Sarah. Thank you so much for being a part of The Next Idea.
Thanks so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. School kids in the 1960s thought it was super cool if a television actually was brought into the classroom so everyone could watch a national event like an Apollo rocket launch. Today's students can be research assistants playing an actual role in research being done aboard the International Space Station. And that's because of a Michigan-based program called Orion's Quest. One of the teachers whose students are taking part in these real-life space science missions is here with us now. Terry McCormick teaches 7th grade science at Smith Middle School in Troy. Terry, it's so good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Terry, this group, Orion's Quest, isn't really creating experiments, but what you're supporting research that's being done on the space station?
Correct. The organization was set up about 13, 14 years ago. And what they do is they act as like a liaison between actual NASA researchers and school students. So they have recruited students from around the country, around the world actually, to act as data analysts for actual NASA researchers.
So how does this work in your classroom, Terry? What are your kids actually doing?
We start out with learning about the mission itself. In the case of STEM on Station, we started out learning a bit about the International Space Station, where the mission is based, and about space exploration, and a little bit about the particular research project and the researchers that are conducting this project. So what our students have done is they view videos of the experiments in progress. So this particular experiment, STEM on Station, involves stem cells that act as beating heart cells. The whole idea behind this is we need to know a lot more information about how microgravity, or being away from Earth's gravity, affects the human body if we're going to continue deeper space exploration, where astronauts are going to be outside of the Earth environment for possibly years at a time. So the beating heart cells are set up as an experiment on the space station, and then as in any good scientific experiment, there has to be a control. So there's a similar experiment set up on the ground. What students do is view video clips of these cells, and they have to analyze the data for the researchers, such as they're looking about for how many areas are beating, the frequency or the number of beats, the uniformity of the beating, how a graph of the beating would look, things like that. And then that information is recorded, and it goes back to the principal researchers.
And that would be Dr. Joseph Wu from Stanford and Dr. Peter Lee from Ohio State, right?
Correct.
So they're really being research assistants. They're doing what the research assistants would do in the laboratory, really, anywhere.
They absolutely are. These long-term experiments take years to really accumulate enough data and analyze it well to come to good conclusions. So what I really like is that there is no instant gratification for students on this, but they really have to see the long-term picture.
Welcome to science, right?
Exactly. Welcome to science. Welcome to space exploration. I did actually one year have a group of students who were mentioned in a scientific research paper that was published in a science journal, which was pretty cool.
Very much so. How does this fit into the learning goals, Terry, that you've built into your curriculum?
Public school standards are updated every 5 to 7 years. I've been lucky to have always been able to teach astronomy because that's my favorite subject. So beyond the obvious connections of the standards, like understanding the movements of solar system objects, our newest standards for science, they're called the Next Generation Science Standards, which are supported by over 40 states, really emphasize systems thinking and systems modeling through focusing on real-life skills of collaboration, communication, student inquiry, student design, leading to developing their own explanations and understandings of material. And these are real-life skills that are applicable everywhere. It's how science operates in the real world, and they get a really good feel of what actually goes on in real-world science experiments by doing this.
So they're really getting a good ground preparation for high school and college and beyond.
Absolutely.
Can you tell, Terry, if there is kind of a different feel or something special for students knowing that this work they're doing is actually connected to something happening on the International Space Station, like different from something that's just living on the pages of a textbook?
Oh, yeah. The classroom connection to the real world really gets their attention. They get very excited about the connection to the space station and real space missions. That connection to real-world science, the connection to, oh, this is what some possible STEM careers look like. The connection to the purposes for space exploration. Why do we spend so much money to continue to explore space? You know, what are the benefits for humanity? What's the common good here? And all of that stuff comes out when we explore these kinds of topics.
And you've been doing this, working with Orion's Quest for a while now. Have you seen it actually spark your students' interest and send them off to pursue STEM careers?
I have. Long-term, I've had students come back into the classroom to visit and, you know, tell me how these types of opportunities have really sparked their interest into pursuing careers in science and specifically astronomy, too.
Terry McCormick teaches 7th grade science at Smith Middle School in Troy, and she has been having her students plug into space research through this program based in Michigan called Orion's Quest. And Mira Manick is one of her students. Hey, Mira.
Hi.
Mira, what kinds of things do you get to do as you're a research assistant for this STEM on Station project?
We collaborate with a lot of people in our class, which is fun because I do have a lot of friends in my class. And we look at the different types of the effects of stem cells, like when they're in the air or when they're on the ground. And it's pretty cool because obviously you get to see what you could go into in the future.
How did you feel about science before this started?
I was always pretty interested in science, but it was really cool and exciting to do.
Well, good luck, and we hope that you continue to enjoy exploring all the wonders of science. Mira Manick, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
When we talk about investing in Michigan's infrastructure, roads, bridges, and water pipes usually come to mind. But what about internet access? High-speed internet is a necessity. Regions without reliable high-speed internet just can't compete. And just as rural parts of the country were last to get electricity in the 20th century, nowadays rural communities across Michigan lag behind cities in access to the internet. One rural electricity cooperative in southwest Michigan is changing that conversation by building a network to bring the fastest internet service, gigabit fiber optic, to its members. Bob Hance is president and CEO of the Midwest Energy and Communication Cooperative. Bob, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be here. Thanks for having us.
Bringing modern technology to rural customers really has been Midwest's mission from the very beginning, which was when?
It would be in the late and mid-30s. These co-ops started across the country about the same time. So many of us have kind of the same technical anniversary date.
That's a long history.
80 years.
So what area does Midwest Energy cover?
Midwest has two distinct service territories for our electric service, one being primarily in southwest Michigan, the other one being in southeast Michigan. We're actually a combination of two electric co-ops that merged back in the late 90s to become then Midwest Energy Cooperative.
And now Midwest Energy and Communications. So you started with power and light, you offer propane, but now let's talk about this fiber speed internet. Just how fast is it?
Well, we're offering up to gig speeds to all of our customers currently. It's actually scalable to something north of 1 gig.
And you know what? Not everybody gets that. How fast is it? If I'm sitting at home and I want to watch something on Netflix, how fast is this internet?
If you can imagine the speed of light in your terms, that's how fast it is. So it's information traveling across a fiber line that's at light speed.
So this is so far ahead of the traditional options for rural customers, right, like satellite or DSL.
It doesn't even compare, and that's something I'm sure we'll talk about with respect to some of our customers' reactions, yes.
Now, so you're building out your Southwest Michigan electric territory to offer this fiber speed internet. So basically what, you're using the existing infrastructure and right of way to get this to homes and businesses?
For the most part, that is correct. We will also be building out our Southeast territory in time. But our first project is a 5-year build project that is only the Southwest portion of our electric service territory.
Tell us how things are going so far.
It's incredible. It's beyond what we ever expected. Our take rates in our most mature areas have already exceeded our business model. We were modeling around 45% take rate, and we're hitting 60% take rate in our more mature area.
So basically, people are saying, oh, yes, we want this.
Yes.
Beyond your expectations.
Beyond our expectations, and actually, we're getting more pressure to get it done faster than we ever anticipated.
What does it take? What's the process of doing this?
You know, it took us nearly 80 years to develop the circuitry and the lines that we have currently serving them with electricity. Now we're trying to basically duplicate that same entire territory in 5 years. So we're building north of 400 miles per year of mainline fiber. And like you mentioned, most of it will be on our aerial system. So it'll be above ground. Where we're underground already with electric, then we will put the fiber underground. So it's effectively just reconstructing this network that we have that duplicates our electric system.
As people get this service and begin to use it, what are you hearing? What needs are being met by this fiber speed internet?
It covers the entire spectrum. We know for a fact that people who are doing education remotely, people with kids at home, families that have to have access to the school system for homework assignments and are doing homework at home, people who have home-based businesses, people who have to work from home from whoever they might work for to be able to be connected at not only high speeds, but certainly without data limits. All those things are included. We expect that it'll keep increasing to include things like remote health care and security and all things that might be relatable to folks who have attached or connected devices in their house.
We had a note that we're actually talking to you. You're speaking to us by phone over this fiber optic network.
That is correct. We're offering not only just internet access, but also a voice service that actually runs on that same piece of fiber.
I've got to imagine business and residential customers both must be very happy with that.
We've heard some incredible stories, and I'll share one in particular that I found very amusing. At one of our district meetings, a gentleman was telling us that he would do a normal weekend call to his mother, who is also connected. For the first time, when they were having this conversation, she interrupted him and said, oh, I forgot to put my hearing aids in, and it turned out she could hear him fine.
Ha!
So the voice was so clear that she didn't even recognize that she hadn't put her hearing aids in that morning.
Bob, have you heard from any businesses who say, you know what, we were thinking of moving away if we didn't get fast, reliable internet?
Niles is a fairly significant community to our south and west. Community, I think, a population around 10, 11,000 folks. They reached out to us because they have an industrial park that was roughly a mile from where we were building our mainline fiber. in conversation with them, we discovered that they had a number of tenants that were threatening to move because of lack of adequate communication services. So we did that build into their industrial park. As a matter of fact, saved not only those businesses, but all the employees that were working there. These folks were struggling, and the last tenant into the industrial park found out that there wasn't any additional copper available to them. So the owner would physically have to take it someplace else and do downloads on thumb drives and bring them back so it could operate. Mm. So in this case, we serve probably 80% of the industrial park now with fiber.
I've got to imagine, as you talk about, you know, jobs that stayed right there, that there is a broader economic impact for the communities that this fiber optic internet's going into.
I can't even imagine how you would measure it, but it's absolutely imperative today. It's an essential service almost as much as electricity is. So in this example, they were threatening to leave to probably go to Indiana, maybe in the South Bend area, because they just need to be connected in this manner today.
Are there any other cooperatives in Michigan doing what you're doing?
There are none that have launched, but we know that there are three that are doing feasibility studies. So Homeworks Tri-County, which is north of Lansing, is probably the closest to getting a place where they can launch. Great Lakes Energy, which is based in Boyne City, is doing a feasibility study, and there's a co-op in the UP called Alger Delta, who's also doing a feasibility study.
Any do's and don'ts you might offer them?
Don't wait too long. Number one, the membership will be there when you build it. If it's, you know, too cliche, it's true. In this case, we weren't really sure or clear how effective it was going to be, but now that we have our feet on the ground, it's very clear that not only is it wanted, it is needed.
So you're pretty much right in the middle of all of this, right? When do you expect to, you know, say, all right, we've done it, we're finished with this phase?
Sometime after I'm retired. In all seriousness, what we're finding out is that through word of mouth, because we're only really marketing and advertising to our current membership, our electric membership, but even though we have kept it confined, we have over 1,000 folks that are not electric members that have also signed up for service. So those who are close by and can see what we're doing are also signing up without even us reaching out to them. We've had contact from places as far away as Traverse City, so that community, knowing that what we're doing or what we're about to do, wanted to know if they built a system, would we be interested in operating it for them. We've heard from the city of Holland for the same reason. We understand South Haven is doing a feasibility study. We've had local townships reach out to us, and again saying, if we can finance it, will you operate it for us? So I don't see a clear end to the process of building off of this system.
Well, the prospect of being able, particularly for the rural areas, to get gigabit fiber optic and have that lightning speed, fastest, what, that's the gold standard of internet speed. It's a pretty great prospect, and it can certainly figure into the conversation about improving infrastructure in Michigan.
Absolutely. And I think this gets lost in this discussion a bit. Not only is it valuable for us, for our members to be able to do business and be educated and, you know, do online things, we need it as an electric utility anyway. So for us to build the infrastructure was going to happen. So why not build it so it's adequate enough to be able to provide this service even to our members directly? Kind of an indirect benefit is that, you know, we're putting the smart grid, building fiber to each of our substations, so in the future we can do lots of different things on energy management that we couldn't do in the past.
Bob Nance is the president and the CEO of Midwest Energy and Communication, building a network bringing the fastest internet service to its members in Southwest Michigan. Great talking with you, Bob. We want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer was Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.